Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the podcast, why not leave a review on iTunes? Your constant validation is all that sustains me through the cold, dark night. Welcome back to Scammapalooza for 2016. There is no guest this week, just me talking about my favourite podcast episodes from last year and from the upcoming year and a few important bits of business. And at the end, I'm going to tell you an extraordinary story from John Scarney, the master of gambling and card cheats. Thank you very much for all of my old listeners who joined me in the first year of the podcast and the brand new ones who've hopefully discovered us over the Christmas period. I had a fantastic Christmas, very, very laid back and very chill, and I had the pleasure of hearing from a bunch of listeners who have been enjoying what we're doing and also had suggested ideas for future episodes, particularly Tim Ellis, who I think every week has got another brilliant idea for an episode of the podcast. My favourites are, he wants me to talk to Teller from Penn and Teller about his film Tim's Veneer, which I think would be brilliant if I could get him. The fact the man doesn't actually speak might make it a little bit difficult for a podcast. And the other story that Tim wanted me to cover was the Sand Dog Hoax, the Metro newspaper. Over a several-week period, they've been covering these British buskers who create what are called sand dogs. So they lay out a tarp, they pile on wet sand, and then they slowly carve the shape of a dog. And they're quite beautiful, and they look extraordinarily realistic. But they're essentially sandcastles. And sandcastles are, I hate to say it, a real thing. However, because of the general public's desire to distrust buskers and street performers, they assume that the men and women who are creating these sand dogs are in fact a part of some massive swindle where they are buying these special molds online, they're packing in the sand and making a sandcastle early in the morning before anyone gets there, and then carving out the shapes of the dogs slowly throughout the day just to add in the little details. It's the same accusation that has also been leveled against the people who do those massive chalk and pastel drawings on the street. When you look closely, you realize it's not actually on the pavement, it's on a canvas that they've laid out. And for some reason, that means that the whole thing is a massive fraud and that they've purchased them online in order to swindle people. The fact is that these are talented artists who really know what they're doing. But I think it is safe to say that a lot of buskers are extraordinarily unoriginal. So you see the same people doing the spray painting onto the records or those weird spray paint moonscapes, or you see street magicians all performing the same cups and balls routine where they produce the apples at the end and the watermelon from under the hat, which, if you don't know, is created by the extraordinary British magician Guzzo. Look him up on YouTube. Amazing performer, and has also written a great book called Phantoms at the Card Table, about a legendary American card cheat that's worth having a look. But while there are a few original guys like Gazzo, most of them are really just recreating what works. Because at the end of the day, busking and street performing is a job. They're not there to necessarily express themselves artistically, they are there to make money. And so carving the shape of a dog is something that makes a lot of money. Putting spray paint onto a record is something that also makes a lot of money. Doing caricatures in the exact same way is something that is commercially successful. That doesn't mean it's a scam, it just means it's good business. So Tim, back off the sand dogs. Also, had the pleasure of bumping into some people who had recognized my voice. So they'd see me on stage, or they'd see me even just in social situations, and leant over and said, "Are you Nicholas J. Johnson from Scammapalooza?" And it was absolutely delightful to meet the people, but odd to realize that the format of podcasting does not provide me with the anonymity that I thought that it did. But thank you very much for people who have run into me and said they've enjoyed the podcast. I should have said to those people, go onto iTunes and leave a review, because podcasts don't survive if they don't get reviews. So if you do enjoy the podcast, please, 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 iTunes review, Stitcher reviews, Downcast reviews, whatever you're using to listen to this, write a review, leave a comment. It really is the only way that this format survives, is from your feedback. Actually, I have to say, I did a podcast recently, Duck Blur, with Michael Williams and Sarah Baggs, and they had a lot of people sending in fan art, because they sit and talk about DuckTales all day, that their listeners tend to sort of send them things related to DuckTales. And I'm a little sad. I have not received a single piece of Scammapalooza fan art. So if you're listening to this and you can draw me a Scammapalooza inspired work, maybe design a Scammapalooza drinking game. There is a Duck Blur drinking game. Why not a Scammapalooza one? Perhaps everyone has to take a drink every time I describe something as delightful or tell an unrelated rambling story in response to a guest's answer. Please do that. Send it to me, conman.com.au, or you can hit me up on social media. It's Honest Conman on pretty much all social media except Twitter, where I am Count Lustig, Lustig. I need to find one single username for all of those formats. Last year, we had 25 episodes, and it was from 25 fantastic guests who all offered a different perspective on the world of con artists, hoaxes, and deceptions. The most popular episodes, I'm not going to say my favorites because I'm far too soft and don't want to offend or upset anyone by letting them know that they're not my absolute favorite. So the most popular ones, the ones with the most downloads. Obviously, the first episode is always a popular one, but it would have been popular nonetheless because it was Lawrence Long who was talking about his TV show Unbelievable, which I think some of the episodes are up on YouTube or at the very least ABC iView. If you're not in Australia, get a VPN, check out abc.net.au and have a look at Lawrence Long's Unbelievable. He then came back to talk about his film Sucker, which has been doing great business around the country and I think is now available on various video on demand formats. Absolutely fantastic movie and definitely worth a look. My sole contribution to the film is that I recommended the hand double for the sleight of hand scenes that Timothy Spall does. So Timothy Spall does some card cheating moves and they do a close-up on his hands. And to do that, they needed a hand double. And so I suggested Barry Govan, who's a Melbourne-based Ballarat-based magician down here in Victoria and extraordinarily talented. But it was an odd experience because I had to go through all of the people I know and say, right, who has old fat hands? Can I recommend them for this job? I felt bad because I actually had to call a couple of them and say, hey, you have old fat hands. Would you like to be a magician's hand double for a movie? And then the people that I spoke to didn't get the part. So I insulted them for nothing. Ah, well, still check out the movie. It's a lot of fun. Another very popular episode was Sarah Baggs, who I mentioned from the Duck Blur podcast, was on talking about the Cottingley Fairies. I thought that was just going to be Sarah and I shooting the shit, talking about what we loved about this story, about two young women who faked some photographs showing that fairies exist. And my God, she did an extraordinary amount of research. And I learned so much about not just the Cottingley Fairies, but the rationalist movement and why people started to believe in things like fairies and paranormal abilities at the beginning of the 20th century, when we're supposed to be becoming more rational and empirical. So that was a fascinating podcast and a lot of fun. I'm going to twist her arm and bring her back again sometime this year. We just need to find the perfect topic for her to discuss. Brian Brushwood, who was also a delight, came on from Scam School. I felt bad because I first saw Scam School many, many years ago and watched like a couple of seconds when some guy with a weird haircut teaching bar bets and stupid magic tricks you can get in any magic book and dismissed him out of hand. And over the years, he has built up an extraordinary web series that I learn from as a professional magician. And I think beginners and, you know, hobbyists and amateurs can also learn a huge amount. Not just about magic, but about mathematics and science, about just how to interact with people and how to be an interesting person in the world. It's not a sleazy pickup artist thing. It's just a nice guy doing extraordinary magic for great people in bars. And if you do get a chance to listen to that podcast, have a listen. And also have a listen to his web series, Scam School. Absolutely delightful guy. And of course, Meso. Nick Mason from the Weekly Planet came on and talked about the movie Now You See Me. I feel terrible about this podcast because a little bit of behind the scenes. I wanted to do a sort of back-to-back Now You See Me special. One where Nick came on and we sort of talked about the film and what we did and didn't like. And also where I interviewed David Kwong, who is a magician and was the magic consultant on the movie Now You See Me. And I recorded both of those on the same day back-to-back. But what I didn't realize was, one, how much David was involved in the film, and two, how I automatically start bagging out movies that I have problems with very, very easily. So I started criticizing the film, throwing around all sorts of stupid remarks and jokes, like, I don't know, like some sort of YouTube commenter. And afterwards, I felt bad because I just met someone who'd been instrumentally involved in the film. And then I decided to just make some cheap laughs by shit-canning the fantastic work that they've done. And it is fantastic work. The fact that you can not just construct a magic trick, but build a magic trick into a story to create a film, to, you know, the extraordinary amount of work and energy and effort that goes into a film, even one that is as flawed and frankly a bit silly as Now You See Me, is something to be admired. And I don't want to be that guy who has a podcast and bags out movies just for my own amusement. That said, Now You See Me 2 is coming out in June, and I really want to have Meso back on the podcast because I really like him. I've got some thinking to do. Also coming up this year, as well as bringing back Meso and Sarah Bags, and hopefully I get Lawrence back because he's doing a Melbourne International Comedy Festival show about magic and puzzles that I think will be fantastic and definitely worth talking about. But we're going to have a bunch of other guests as well coming on. So Simon Caterson is coming back. We just recorded an episode where we talk about the Orson Welles film F is for Fake, and that is packed full of references to classic scams and hoaxes. We talk about the War of the World hoax. We talk about the Clifford Irving, Howard Hughes biography. We talk about fake paintings and forgers. That is a dense podcast with a lot of incredible stuff to learn. So please go out and watch the movie F is for Fake right now. Not only is it a great movie, but you'll be able to listen to the podcast and understand a little bit more. We didn't give people warning last time we did one of those episodes, and we kind of spoiled the film for people who would have gone to see it had they known. It was when we talked about Nightmare Alley. I'm also talking to Alex Palmer, who's a New York writer, about the book The Santa Claus Man, which is about the history of writing letters to Santa Claus and the Jazz Age confidence man who helped to make that into a thing. So the idea of writing letters to Santa came from somewhere, and it came from a con man. I'd like your feedback on this, because one of my favorite books is, and this is where I'm going to sound even more pretentious than I already do, one of my favorite books is The Little Golden Calf, which is a Soviet-era Russian novel, which is a sort of a satire of Soviet politics. And there's a brilliant movie, which I'll try and upload onto YouTube with the subtitles so you can see, because there's nowhere else to see it with subtitles. It's a lot of fun. It's a funny book and a funny movie, and the way in which they use the con artist genre to talk about Soviet politics is very interesting. My problem is I feel like I'm already a pretty pretentious, vaguely condescending guy. If I talk about this book on the podcast, is that a bridge too far? Am I going to disappear too far up my own backside? I don't know. Anyway, love your thoughts on that. And of course, if you do have other suggestions for episodes, please, please let me know, because I want to put together the podcast that you guys want to listen to. And frankly, I'm not original enough to fill all of these episodes with my own ideas. I want to hear from you as well. To finish up with of this special one-off sort of beginning of the year episode, I'm going to tell you a story. And I'm going to read you a story from a book called Scarny's New Complete Guide to Gambling. John Scarny is a legend in the world of card cheaters and swindlers, a man who dedicated his life not to being a cheat, but to exposing and uncovering them. He has written an extraordinary number of books, and perhaps the classic tome by Scarny is Scarny on Gambling, an encyclopedia of not only how to play games, but how to cheat at them and how to spot a swindler in process. The book is also scattered with stories from Scarny's adventures uncovering con artists and card cheats around America. And one particular story grabbed my attention, that of the Blondie Mob. It's a classic locked room mystery where a team of beautiful swindlers manage to take a bookie for $100,000 in a room that is completely locked and sealed, with no way that they can possibly cheat at all. The story is a little misogynistic, but it's a fantastic tale nonetheless. This is John Scarny and the Blondie Mob. The most ingenious system for fleecing bookmakers that has come to my attention was employed by the Blondie Mob, so called because the members were five attractive looking girls, all blondes, ranging in age from 23 to 35. How much money these girls stole is anybody's guess. Some gamblers placed a figure at $1 million, others at $2 million. I know for sure that they fleeced one bookmaker out of $100,000. As a gambling authority and consultant, I'm sought after by law enforcement agencies, governments where gaming is illegal, private clubs and organizations, and individuals who've lost large sums of money and believe that they've been cheated but don't know exactly how. My policy is not to accept assignments from gamblers who operate illegally, but I did accept this one because of its peculiar circumstances and the challenge that it offered. The incident goes back a number of years. I was in Los Angeles, having just returned from a tour of army camps in Alaska, where I'd been lecturing to the GIs. The telephone in my hotel room rang one day, and a voice said, "Mr. Scarney, my name is Quinn. I wonder if you are available to take on a gambling assignment." I told him I might be if the price was right, and if it interested me. An hour later, I entered a penthouse apartment in one of Hollywood's most fashionable districts. A butler opened the door, and I followed him into the study where Mr. Quinn waited. I recognized him instantly as one of the top bookmakers on the West Coast. He was far more intelligent man than most bookies. I guessed by his speech that he had an accountant's training, but had realized that it made much more sense and was much easier money to be made as a bookmaker. "Scarney," he said, "I handle one of the biggest books on the West Coast. My daily handle is seldom less than 30 grand, and I think I know the ins and outs of the business. But I have a question. Do you think it's possible for a woman horse bettor to be so lucky she can overcome a bookmaker's percentage and win $100,000 within a 4-week period? A woman horse player has beaten you for 100 grand in 4 weeks? "That's correct. After she won 50 grand, I began to think that maybe it wasn't just luck. Maybe she's just plain smart and had some angle for betting the races that really worked. Maybe not. I have a special room in the apartment, but only big bettors are ever invited into it, and the girl is one of them." I followed him across the large living room and through a door into a well-equipped bookmaking room. It had all the standard paraphernalia: an adding machine, betting slips, racing sheets, ledger, telephone, table, and several comfortable chairs. Quinn said, "This room is on the top floor of the building. It's air-conditioned and soundproof and has no windows. What's more, my players must arrive here before post time. After post time, no one is allowed off the elevator at this floor until after the last race. I don't see how anyone in this room can get any information from outside. The bettors are not permitted to make or receive phone calls while they're here. The phone number is not listed. If Blondie is getting information, I don't know how." I told Quinn that my policy is not to make investigations for gamblers or gambling casinos operating outside the law. "But," I said, "I'm as curious now as you are, so I'm going to try and find out what's happening. If Blondie is cheating, she may be the smartest cheater I've ever seen." The next afternoon found me scanning a scratch sheet in Mr. Quinn's luxurious bookmaking parlor. Several of his big-time customers were there, including the smartly dressed and attractive Blondie. I could see at once that she didn't have a radio-receiving gimmick on her. The low-neck dress she wore was a tight fit and no room to spare. When the races were over, Blondie was a 2 grand winner. After she and the other bettors had gone, Mr. Quinn turned to me and asked, "Well, is she lucky or smart?" I smiled. "She's smart. She's been past posting you. And the guy who's been tipping her off is you." "Me?" he exclaimed. "That's impossible." "I don't think so. When Blondie gave you the $300 straight win bet on High Noon in the third race at Haler Park, it was already a couple of minutes after post time." "So what? I let my bettors put bets down a few minutes after post in this room all the time. As a matter of fact, I don't even bother to look at the clock. When I get the results of a race over the telephone from my main office, I stop taking bets. But not until then. How could she get the name of the winner in this soundproofed room? If a bomb exploded across the street, you couldn't hear it in here." "Like this," I replied. Blondie knew that the third race at Haley Park had been run, and she got a coded message from a Confederate on the outside. A Confederate who relayed the dope through you. Her Confederate is the person who called in the bet on snowshoes in the eighth race at Haley. Mr. Quinn immediately turned to the table and scanned his ledger. "That was May, another blonde, but I still don't get the whole gimmick. May called in quite a number of bets, didn't she?" "Yes, But what has the snowshoes bet in the eighth got to do with the bet on High Noon in the third race? May is operating from a room that has a direct line from one of the wire services. She gets the results of the race a minute or so after the race is over. As soon as she knew High Noon had won the third race, she phoned and gave you a bet of 50, 20 and 10 on snowshoes in the eighth. And she asked you to repeat it, which you did. Blondie heard you say, "You bet me 50, 20 and 10 on snowshoes in the eighth at Hayley." And Blondie simply added the first digits of the amount of the bet, got an answer of 8, and knew that the horse listed as number 8 on her scratch sheet had won the third race. What is number 8 on Blondie's and your scratch sheet? Quinn looked at it. It's High Noon. Okay, that's it. I learned from Quinn that there were 5 blondes in the mob, and that before they took him, many of the other bookies in the Los Angeles area had gotten the same treatment. I don't know what happened to the Blondie mob, but I do know that they had a real sweet gimmick and worked it more expertly than any male mob of cheaters had ever come to my attention. So that is it for this week. We are going to be back with next week, as I said, more guests, more scams, more cons. Please send me your ideas. And of course, check out www.conman.com.au to learn about my projects. I've got shows coming up. I've got 2 novels, Chasing the Ace and Fast and Loose. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this has been Scammapalooza.